Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. In April 1893, John Marshall, an immigrant and successful farmer on Sumas Prairie in British Columbia, was found dead lying sprawled across the veranda of his farmhouse. The farmer's face was a mess, his nose smashed in and cracked blood covering his forehead around a jagged black hole. The shocked neighbor who discovered the body rushed to summon the authorities. An autopsy, coroner's inquest, and murder investigation followed. 2 days later, a handyman named Albert Strobel was arrested for Marshall's murder. Strobel was an unlikely killer, short and physically disabled. The young man the community knew was not capable of murder, and locals were shocked to imagine that Strobel could have killed the man who had treated him like family. But something had gone tragically wrong on the night Marshall died. Unraveling the mystery would take 9 months and two lengthy trials that seized the attention on both sides of the Canadian-American border, splitting them into pro- and anti-Strobel factions. Newspapers devoted page after page of coverage, and throngs of spectators squeezed into the courtroom galleries. The first trial in New Westminster ended with the jury hopelessly deadlocked. The second in Victoria found him guilty and set an impending date for his execution. The heaviest hitters of BC's political and legal establishment took part, including former and current premiers, an attorney general, and a future Supreme Court justice. When the second trial ended with a guilty verdict and death sentence, many in the public howled in protest, convinced that a young man had been condemned to die for a crime he did not commit. And the dramatic events would not stop there. With the condemned man sitting on death row, the case would take more twists and turns that would lead Albert Strobel to the shadow of the gallows. The book that we're featuring this evening is The Trials of Albert Strobel, Love, Murder and Justice at the End of the Frontier, with my special guest author Chad Reimer. Welcome to the program, and thank you very much for this interview, Chad Reimer.
Well, thank you for having me on.
Thank you very much. It's a very fascinating case, very, very interesting. When we set it in the time frame of the 1890s in Canada, on the along the Canada-US border, tell us a little bit about the Sumas Prairie of British Columbia. Set the stage for a little bit of the history of this area and just where this geographically is in on this Canadian-American border. Tell us where this is.
Right. Today, it's actually, there's a town called Huntington, which is south of Abbotsford, British Columbia. And both of those are about a 45-minute drive east of Vancouver, British Columbia. And you come down out of Vancouver, and you come off a rise in the Fraser Valley, and you go down onto this prairie, Sumas Prairie. And it's the events that took place are right along just as you come down onto the bottom of the prairie. And right now at Huntington, it's a border crossing. Huntington is the Canadian side of the border crossing, and then Sumas City is the American side. And a railroad, a couple of railroads, go straight north-south, connecting Mission across the Fraser River to north, and then going south into the United States. In the 1890s, that prairie was very, very lightly settled. It's actually quite remarkable how recent it was that there were so few people around on the prairie. you know, so few white settlers, and of course the native peoples had been pushed aside, dispossessed of the land, and pushed on to reserve lands in the Sumas Prairie. The dominating feature on the prairie to the east was a wide lake, a lake that spanned from one side of the prairie along Sumas Mountain to the other side of the prairie along Better Mountain, about 4 miles or 6 kilometers across, and then about 6 miles, 9 kilometers long. That was called Sumas Lake. That was there at the time. It was drained in the 1920s. So that was a dominating feature to you know, the one side. And then the other side is this sharp escarpment that came down from the west. That's where the edge of the last ice age went. And the events that were happening, that we talk about, happened on the western edge of that prairie. And just after, 2 years after, the Canadian Pacific Railway had built a spur line from Mission, which is on the north side of the Fraser Valley, straight, you know, built a bridge and then straight down south to hook up with the Northern Pacific Railway that came across in Washington State. And the railway itself kind of sparked a bit of a boom, and then the boom kind of faded after a little while. But it mostly developed the Sumas City on the American side. And so the Sumas City was the town that even all the Canadians on the north of the border, they would go if they needed a doctor or if they wanted to go shopping, they would go into Sumas City because there was no other real town around. Abbotsford didn't emerge as a real town for quite a while. Chilliwack was across Sumas Lake. So these people, the Sumas Prairie, their life was more north-south, and they went across the line as if the line didn't exist, kind of thing. And actually, for many white settlers, about half of them were actually Americans. So they thought, well, we don't have to recognize this line at all. So, and the geography, topography, it was a mixture. It was on the very edge of rich grasslands, which were produced because Sumas Lake grew every year with the floods and then went away, and they produced these grasslands. And on the grasslands, you had the sheep, the cattle and dairy cattle, beef cattle. By the time you get closer to where the railroad was and where all these events take place, it was more marshy and boggy and bushy. So it was very, very difficult to make a go of farming. And so the farmer, like a victim, John Marshall, you know, he was one of the more successful, actually. But it was still, you know, a hard slog for him. And you also had, you know, like every frontier, you had the population, the white population, was very recent. And you had people coming and going all the time. And Marshall had been there for 10 years, and he was an old-timer. And the young man arrested for his murder, Albert Strobel, he also had been there, you know, almost 10 years. His family had come. And he had bounced back and forth across the border. He'd lived mostly in the B.C. side. His family lost their property, and then a year or two before, he had moved back into the American side, the Sumas City side. But like I say, every day people were walking up and down, and there was no good road, so they used the railroad to walk up and down, going, you know, from Sumas Prairie and Canadian side to Sumas City. And, you know, the events of the book, they're, you know, you're constantly moving back across, up and down that railway line. And it kind of, you know, it becomes a character in itself in the in the book, that line itself, it's connecting. It directly connects Albert Strobel's hotel that he's staying in to John Marshall's property, which has a gate right at the railway bed that, you know, you'd go off and go into his property.
Right.
But that's kind of the economic and the physical setting for the events.
Now tell us about the relationship between Albert and this Portuguese immigrant, which had difficulty, you know, had a thick accent. And so tell us about this unlikely friendship and what that friendship entailed.
Yes, they actually were quite, well, I don't know if close would be a good term for it, but Strobel was one of the most frequent visitors to John Marshall's place. He would come up and he would come up and help with the chores in the house. He would help with some of the chores around the farmyard as well. They were both kind of outsiders in amongst the Sumas Prairie community. Marshall, because he was Portuguese, and there was very strong racism at the time for, you know, Southern Europeans and Portuguese in particular. He actually came from the Azores Islands off of Portugal, so his accent would have been even more stronger, more regional Portuguese. He was known as the old man and the old man that was killed, and yet he actually was only about 38 or 39. And it's kind of like the descriptions of him, you get the sense, well, this is kind of like an exotic guy, you know. We don't really know much about him, but, you know, so we can describe him the way we want. And then Strobel was an outsider, partly because of his family. I mean, he came from a broken family. His mother had died a few years before the events. He had a half dozen siblings that were still with him. His father kind of lost it after his mother died. He was a veteran of the Civil War, and he was a German immigrant himself, had come to Illinois, and that's where Strobel was born. And the family had come out west in the 1880s. And his father was very restless. He didn't stay at any one particular thing. He was continually going off, leaving the kids to take care of themselves. He had a problem with alcohol, as invariably so many did, because it was, you could buy very strong alcohol back then, unregulated. And he disappeared by the time these events took place. And so his family was poor. Not that there weren't other poor families, but it was poor and it was parentless. And the kids were just trying to hold it together. And Strobel himself was a bit of an oddball. Of course, physically, he had a deformity of his right leg that twisted it and then twisted his foot in some form. Obviously, he wouldn't have been going to a doctor or a specialist to get a diagnosis, but he had been told it was an inflammation of his bone. And so that left him it left him disabled. And of course, at that time, it's like, oh, that kind of defined him, right? And he was, you know, not a big fellow to begin with, and so he was short, and then with his leg even shorter. And he was, you know, what nowadays might be called developmentally challenged, or certainly emotionally challenged. He was always referred to as the boy, even though by the time of the murder, he was 20 years old, and at that time in that frontier society, you know, a man at 20 years old is a man. You know, you're out of your family, you're making your own family and so forth. But he was seen as the boy. And in part because he just, you know, he was clever enough in some things, but he wasn't quite there in others. And also, you know, emotionally he was kind of, he was, you know, behind his, behind the times with his age and so forth. And so they were both outsiders. They kind of, you know, for Strobel, he didn't have a real home. And for Marshall, he didn't have a family around. So they kind of, you know, it was kind of like a, you know, an uncle and a nephew type relationship that they developed. And they seemed to like each other quite, you know, as much, not that they got to know each other well, but they liked each other's company. So,
but, right. Yeah. Now tell us about the relationship. You talked about this delayed emotional and development where they called him just the boy, but he had recently been in a relationship. His landlord was Margaret Bartlett. So he rented a room from her, but she had three daughters, and one of them was Elizabeth, was 12 years old. Tell us about this recent love affair, and if it was approved or condoned by Margaret. Tell us about this relationship and what it meant to Albert.
Yeah, Elizabeth was the third oldest of the Bartlett daughters, and there were eight Bartlett children, and Margaret was the mother. Elizabeth was known to be, people around believed her to be 14 years old, and government records show, though, that she is definitely 12. And yes, the two of them did develop a relationship. At first, the mother, Margaret, wasn't crazy about it. The father in the situation, Charles Bartlett, was kind of, once again, he was another father who was kind of out of the picture, not physically, but he, you know, was another guy who just tried numerous things and nothing seemed to stick. He actually lived north of the line in Chilliwack and Yale for a good while and ran a hotel that burned down. He forgot to get the insurance, so they were left with nothing. And so Margaret Bartlett moved the whole family south of the line, and she bought the hotel. So she was very much in charge. He didn't stay at home very often. He passed out in the bar and slept in the bar wherever he was. So, and she did eventually come around to in the midst of the trials and the testimony, she did come around. Both Elizabeth and Albert claimed that they were engaged. They were officially engaged. And they said they had been talking about it with the mother. The mother said, well, maybe I don't think they were officially engaged, but they were, you know, related. They were in a relationship. And, you know, Elizabeth, she had said, well, if the murder hadn't happened, they would have been married, right? Mm-hmm. And I do address this, and I say, oh, well, geez, she's 12 years old. Can they get married? And the answer is, in law, yes, they can. The marriage laws for Washington state were that marriage age was 18 for a woman, 21 for a man. Now, that only applied if the parents of the daughter getting married protested. If they said, well, no, we don't give her approval to get married. If they don't protest, then there was no other age limit for getting married. And right. The fact that she was thought to be 14 was significant because Margaret Bartlett got married at 14. The mother of David Ayerly, who is this little budding sociopath that was Albert Strobel's co-defendant in the first trial. She was 14 when she got married. Both of them, both Bartlett and Mark and Airlie's mother were 15 when they had their first children. And Theodore Davy, who was the premier at the time, and he was one of the most impressive minds that BC had produced at the time, he married a girl that was 14 back in the 1870s, and she died. So it wasn't unusual on the frontier for girls at 14 to be married. So nobody really raised, as I say, they thought, and the family kind of didn't protest about Elizabeth being thought of as 14, right? And Margaret didn't say anything. And from their perspective, you know, Margaret, you know, daughters were useful. These families were big. Boys were useful on the farm, and daughters were useful in the house and raising the kids. And when they didn't become useful, they wanted to marry the daughters off because they became, you know, dependent. So marrying daughters off at 14 or 15 isn't a bad thing if you have other daughters to help around the house, which the Bartletts did.
Right.
So this was not as unusual as you would think it would be.
Sure. Let's talk about, as somebody talking about marriage, and they talked about an engagement, and so the mother knew, the father knew. But at the time, he had no job prospects. He had talked about some money that he had, but it was complicated. He said he had money in a bank in New Westminster. I'll have you explain that briefly. We don't get too far into that. But the idea that he had no prospects for jobs, but he had approached a couple guys, a couple barbers, because his idea was that he would like to be a barber, someday open a shop.
Right.
So he did approach a couple people. But how serious was he in the approach? With the first one, with the apprenticeship, and then the second one, what did he say in terms of trying to secure the barbershop business from this gentleman named Carpenter? Tell us a little bit about his prospects about being a barber.
Yeah, I think he was completely serious about being a barber, and it was one of his, you know, more realistic plans. He knew, you know, being a barber was a bit easier on his leg, of course. You know, working behind a plow in a field isn't the easiest thing to do when you're regular walking, you have to use a cane. Now, he did physical work, of course, because he had to. Didn't have much of any school training, and so being a barber would have been a good thing for him. And the only problem is, of course, you know, barbers come and go. I mean, the two that he approached, the first fellow, he gave his horse it was the only asset that Albert owned was his horse.
Right.
He gave him the horse to take him on as an apprentice. That guy's shop burned down, and he left. So then Carpenter opened a barber shop, and Strobel said, "Okay, I'll buy the barber shop from you, with everything in it, and I'll also buy some household, you know, things, maybe a sofa, chairs, that sort of thing, for, you know." And Carpenter said, "Well, the asking price is $250." And Strobel said, "Well, that's fine. I have $500 in the bank, and, you know, I'll be able to pay you." Now, these talks apparently, like, according to Carpenter, well, he's a dodgy character. According to Carpenter, the talks had been going on for a bit, right up until the day that that Strobel was arrested, and that Margaret Bartlett and Elizabeth Bartlett knew about these talks, knew about these plans. So from the sound of it, this kind of was the plan, that Strobel was going to get the money to buy Carpenter's barbershop. That would set him up. and that would, you know, be the basis for, you know, him being able to support getting married to Elizabeth. So Margaret kind of knew about this, and you know, that that would have been the plan. The only thing was, Strobel had no money. He said he had the $500 in the bank, but, and he probably kind of believed it, but through some really dodgy real estate stuff that his older brother, Albert's older brother, had been involved in, his older brother then kind of passed on these heavily mortgaged property to him, Albert. And so Albert thought he had these properties. I don't think he was aware that there was a full mortgage on them. And the bank comes and asks him for the money. He ends up signing the property over. And then in his mind, he signs the property over but gets no money. And so he thinks the bank stole his money. So that's what he was thinking about. Yes, I have the money. So that's kind of the picture where he just kind of doesn't get the big picture. Strobel doesn't. He doesn't understand that, well, actually, those properties weren't worth anything because there's a huge mortgage. Now, of course, his older brother probably, you know, if he did tell him about the mortgages, he had to have known that Strobel, Albert, wouldn't have understood very well what was going on. So his older brother certainly shares some of the blame here, as does the bank in Sumas City, who through its agent, like Albert, for quite a good ride on this whole thing. So right. The money wasn't there. They thought it was, I think, and the plan was there, and it wasn't a bad plan, but the money just wasn't there.
Let's get to April 16th, and George Hilliard and also Albert. They're fishing at Marshall Creek, and it's named after John Marshall.
Yep.
They get skunked fishing that day, so they stop at Marshall's for some milk, which is, he has a cow, and they'd stopped many times before. And like you say, Albert's the kind of guy that visits him more than anyone else. So, and likely as they are friends, they see each other all the time, and they're friendly, and they act like friends, and they can stop. He can stop over for a glass of milk.
Mm-hmm.
What does Marshall invites them for lunch?
Mm-hmm.
What does he talk about to these two gentlemen, to Albert and his friend? What does he say?
Yeah. Actually, it's not Albert that's there with Hilliard. They come, George, and that comes back and tells Albert about this meeting.
Right.
It's actually Elizabeth Bartlett's younger brother,
George. Yes.
George Bartlett. So you got George Hilliard, who's, you know, not, I think he's around 19. An English, you know, he's an immigrant from England. And then you've got George Bartlett, who's 11 or 12. The two of them go down to fish, as you say, in Marshall Creek, and yes, named after John Marshall. It's in behind Marshall's house. And they, as they've done before, because Marshall's a jovial enough fellow, he gives them some milk, and then he wants the company, so he asks them to stay for lunch, which they do. And he gets talking about, Marshall does, he gets talking in a very boastful way about his girlfriend, the girlfriend that he has. And Hilliard kind of eggs him on in a teasing way, right, because it would be like, here's this guy, he doesn't speak very good English, I'm going to kind of, like, needle him along. And so Marshall starts talking about, yeah, I've got a girlfriend, and, you know, I'm going to go buy her a dress, and you know, I have the money for it. And Marshall goes off and gets this leather bag of coins, and he spills them out on his hand, and half a dozen or so $20 coins, and shows them to the boys. And they're just, you know, of course, their eyes just light right up at this. And, they finish up the lunch, and, you know, Marshall's happy with himself bragging about these things, and George Hilliard and George Bartlett go back to the hotel, and George Bartlett is actually Albert Strobel's roommate. So it's Strobel's renting a house in Margaret Bartlett's hotel, the city hotel, and there's the two beds, and so George Bartlett is on one bed and Albert Strobel is in the other. And so they come back and, you know, they tell Albert all about this meeting that they had with Marshall. And they told him, certainly they told him about the money. And I'm, it's pretty guaranteed they would also have told him about, you know, Marshall talking about his girl. And so Albert, you know, knew these two things, which would be very important in the events that happened, you know, over the next few days.
Absolutely. Let's get to what happens. You have a neighbor named Ira Earhart, and around 9 p.m., he hears a dog barking, and he thinks it might be from next door, from Marshall's. He's a trapper, so he thinks it might be a bear in one of the traps, but he is not going to go over there. There's not enough for him to say, I got to go over there. So he goes over there the next morning, just after dawn, and to have a little bit of milk for his dog. Get some milk. What does he find?
He finds John Marshall sprawled out on the veranda of his cabin, Marshall's cabin. Marshall's head was propped up. He's on his back. Marshall's head is propped up on the sill of the door, and his body, his feet are pointed outwards. So his feet are hanging off the edge of the veranda, and Earhart comes close enough. He doesn't come and touch the body or see if he's alive or anything like that. But he comes close enough, and he sees the nose had been, you know, there's, he thought at first it was mud, but it was dried blood all over his front of his face. And you know, a dark spot on his forehead and stuff. And he thought that Marshall had been clubbed to death. So he heads off down the CPR line down to the Huntington rail station. That's where they have the telegraph and everything to let people know what he's found.
Right. Now, he contacts authorities, and you have a couple lawmen. Moresby is involved here.
Yep.
Tell us what police find from the initial examination of the crime scene, and just tell us who's involved with this investigation and how police proceed.
Yeah. So what happens is that the Earhart informs the station master at the Huntington station. So this is, you know, this is like at dawn, first thing in the morning. And the station master, there's no police in the area. You know, there's not a single constable between New Westminster and Hope and Yale. So the station master telegraphs New Westminster, and William Moresby is both the warden of the provincial jail and also the acting superintendent of police on the mainland. The real superintendent is in Victoria, and Moresby gets in touch with a former sergeant in the British Army by the name of Pittendry, George Pittendry, who's the coroner. And they've worked on cases before. So Moresby and Pittendry jump onto the next train, and, you know, 2-3 hours later, the train goes to New Westminster, to Mission down. They get off at Marshall's place. the two of them, and Moresby is of course the one in charge of now in charge of the investigation. When they get to Marshall's place, what they see is like a couple dozen men milling around, walking around the place, stomping all over the yard, and a bunch of men huddled up on the veranda, looking over Marshall's body, which somebody had thrown a coat onto. So Moresby comes up. I don't think he was the one to use oaths under his breath, but he was not happy about all these people traipsing around. He comes up and he starts investigating, takes the blanket off of Marshall's body, and he investigates. He sees a hole in the forehead of John Marshall, right above the eyebrow, left eyebrow. And he turns him over, and he notices, of course, too, the broken nose. He turns him over and sees another hole, jagged hole, in the lower, the part of where the neck joins your back or shoulders, at the base of the base of your neck. And he thinks, that it might be the exit wound from the hole in the front of his head. So he looks around, but he can't find any bullets on the veranda or in the walls or whatever. Not a lot of blood. He was quite surprised. There's almost no blood. There's a pool of it where Marshall's head was, but other than that, there's no real much blood around. And he goes in and he glances around the inside, and he doesn't really do an inspection of the inside. The fellow who had taken charge was a local justice of the peace, and he told Moresby that he had done a search of the house and found a couple of leather pouches of money, one with coins and another with dollar bills. With big bills from the Bank of British Columbia. And Moresby, on Marshall's body itself, Moresby had found a pouch that had was lying on Marshall's stomach, a pouch with about $10 in it, along with his pipe. So it had either been taken out of his pocket, the pouch and that, or it had come out of his pocket when he fell. And Moresby, he doesn't look much at the crime scene, notices the thing he noticed most was the kitchen table had been set for two. There were a couple of plates and that. There were leftovers on the table. The chairs had been tipped over, the two chairs, as if people had just gotten out from supper. So it's obvious two people had been sitting down having supper. There's always one curious clue that sticks out, and this crime scene, there was a pot of boiled potatoes stranded halfway between the stove and the table. So and it was upright and everything, so he couldn't figure out how that got there. Nobody ever did. Moresby then heads out, and he has to go back down to the Huntington Station and start organizing his investigation and notifying his superiors and so forth. And that starts his investigation going. While Coroner Pittendry, of course, the system is that the coroner is there. He pulls a jury of a half dozen or so people close around, and they hold a coroner's inquest. But that night, right, they view the body, and the next day you have the official coroner's inquest. And those two things get the investigation going.
Right. Now, you talk about Moresby taking over this investigation, and a person named David Lucas a private investigator getting involved. And also, there had been someone named William Porter that spoke to Moresby, and he had been ditching with Strobel at the Marshall Farm, I believe. So there, and Porter believed that or suspected that Albert was involved. And so how do Lucas and Moresby proceed with questioning Albert Strobel?
Right. David Lucas is a, you know, he's one of those characters that, as a writer, historian, true crime writer, you love to have on the scene. You know,
right.
he was just like straight out of, as I say in books, straight out of central casting. As if Wyatt Earp had walked onto the stage, and a lot of very similarities, because Earp himself respected the law only as much as was convenient. Lucas was living in Sumas City. He moved there a few years earlier, and he actually was the first marshal of the city. At first, he was paid, you know, properly by the city council, but with the economic bust of the previous year, the city council had to, you know, they couldn't pay him full time. He had, you know, he did bit work. You know, if he arrested somebody for, you know, a city violation, then he'd get some money for that. So he had to go back to selling milk and so forth. But he had been the marshal of Sumas City, and he actually had experience as a private investigator because his brother, Lucas's older brother, had run one of the more successful private investigator companies on the West Coast, you know, like the Pinkertons, but not as big. And his older brother was in, well, actually Albert, I mean, Lucas himself had various scrapes with the law themselves up on charges for, well, his brother for, you know, bribery and you know, mishandling client funds and kidnapping and all these things. So he, you know, David Lucas learned all the tricks of the trade from his brother. And when he was marshal of Sumas City, he was kind of allowed to do, what he wanted to keep the peace. Because in the boom years, there were all kinds of, you know, bars and brothels and gambling houses and everything in Sumas City. And the city council thought, well, this guy, David Lucas, he's a perfect guy for this. You know, he'll go after, you know, he doesn't much know about, you know, rights of the defendant and so forth, and those don't really matter that much. So actually, Moresby was quite relieved. He didn't know Lucas from before, but he met Lucas at Marshall's house. Lucas had gone down there in the morning, and Lucas filled Moresby in on everything and so forth. And from that time on, the two of them then go back, go down to the Huntington station, set up headquarters in the Huntington Hotel, and from that point on, the two of them work together in the investigation of Strobel. And they pretty much, from that time, Strobel was their primary suspect in that.
Let's use this as an opportunity just to stop for a second to talk about our sponsor, which is FabFitFun. Discover why over 1 million women are obsessed with this seasonal subscription box service. In every FabFitFun box, you'll receive 8 to 10 full-size items that range from beauty to home decor to apparel to jewelry and beyond every season. The Spring 2020 box has been revealed and is now on sale for a limited time. My wife Lisa is always excited about getting another FabFitFun box. This time, she ordered the makeup finishing spray from Skindinavia, and she loves it. Now it's part of her daily routine, essential, she says. She also chose Glow Wrinkle Treatment by Revive Light Therapy and Rapid Collagen Infusion by Murad Resurgence. She already uses the Goat Milk Moisturizing Cream by Kate Somerville, and she has incorporated these amazing FabFitFun products into her everyday health routine. She's been hitting the gym 3 days a week, feeling and looking healthier, and with her FabFitFun beauty and health products, she's looking and feeling even better. Thanks, FabFitFun. Now, these are just some of the products Lisa chose for herself. The boxes are customizable. If you just want to get surprised, though, the FabFitFun team will curate a selection of products just for you. FabFitFun is happiness delivered straight to your door each season. Choose from a variety of beauty, fashion, and wellness products to customize your very own spring box. It retails for $49.99, but always has a value over $200. Use coupon code MURDER for $10 off your first box at www.fabfitfun.com. Use coupon code MURDER for $10 off your first box at www.fabfitfun.com. Now, Chad, we were talking about the build-up, the impetus for Moresby and with the help of David Lucas to be able to arrest Albert Strobel for the murder of Marshall. What does it take to be able to, you talk about this ruse that they did to lure him from the U.S. side to the Canadian side. Tell us how they did this and what was the ruse?
Yeah, I mean, one of the advantages Moresby saw, of course, in having David Lucas as his unofficial partner was that, right from the start, they suspected Strobel because Strobel had been seen that day, the day of John Marshall's murder, when he was ditching with William Porter. He had flashed his revolver. He had carried a revolver with him, and he had been seen with a revolver. He was believed to be the last one to see Marshall alive. So Moresby sends Lucas down into Sumas City because, of course, Moresby himself, his authority was only north of the line. And Lucas is able he picks up some cartridges from spent cartridges and live cartridges from Strobel's room and outside his room. He tricks Strobel into handing over his gun, which would be the most decisive piece of evidence. And then he goes down at one point, and Strobel is outside talking to some friends, and Lucas comes up and he starts talking to him, and Strobel says, "Oh, you're here to arrest me, aren't you?" And Lucas says, no, I'm not." And so Lucas starts talking to him about the investigation, and he's teasing him with information about how they're going and how it's going and so forth. And as he's doing this, they're walking south, and before Strobel knows it, they're in front of the Huntington Hotel on the Canadian side. And Lucas says, "Oh, why don't you come in and have a drink? I'll treat you." And Strobel doesn't want to do that, but he's finally convinced. And he gets a strawberry wine or some kind of very soft drink, and Lucas gets his bourbon. And then they come outside, and Strobel thinks, "Oh, good, I can go home now." And then as a couple steps walking back, William Moresby comes up behind him and puts his hand on Strobel's shoulder and arrests him there, then and there, for the murder of John Marshall.
Right.
So obviously this whole thing had been choreographed beforehand between Moresby and Lucas to lure Strobel across the line so that Moresby could arrest him.
How is it that they get how does he trick him to get his gun? What's the ruse to talk about the gun? That's a very interesting
yeah, the gun.
Deception.
So, you know, one of these Lucas is going back and forth, talking to Marsby at the Huntington Hotel, going into Sumas City to investigate. And during one of these, he's talking with Strobel just outside the city hotel. And the coroner's inquest hadn't really happened yet. And, you know, autopsy results and so forth. But Lucas says, oh, yeah, I've just heard from the doctor that the gun that killed Marshall was a 44 caliber. And Strobel lights up and says, oh, well, that leaves me out. I only have a 38 caliber. And Lucas says, whoa, well, can I see it? And Strobel, you know, he's thinking, oh, you know, I'll go get it and show him and convince him it's not the gun. So he goes up to his room, comes back down with the revolver, and he shows it to Lucas, and Lucas takes it, looks at it, sees that, you know, a couple have been fired, and, you know, he could see that a couple of cartridges had been fired and a couple were still in there, and he snaps it shut and puts it in his pocket. And Strobel says, you can't do that. You can't take my revolver. And Luke says, oh, well, I'm just collecting everybody's around here. And at that point, he turns around and goes back down to Huntington Hotel. And, of course, that revolver would be, you know, the centerpiece of the prosecution case against Albert Strobel in the trials.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Let's talk about this gun just briefly. We got to talk about this trial because, of course, he's arrested, and we have to talk about his nemesis, this very interesting David Franklin Ierley. But just briefly, tell us about the state of the gun. This is an ordinary gun, and at the time of in terms of ballistics expertise centered around that all guns like this, especially this common gun, were rusty. Just tell us briefly about this gun and the rustiness of it, and its importance.
It was a cheap, you know, generic gun, trade gun. It wasn't a Colt or a Smith & Wesson or anything like that. Five bullet revolver, 38 caliber, which had by that time become the most common caliber for a revolver. It would have been fairly short barreled, and you know, Strobel got it. He would never have cleaned it. He didn't have the proper cleaning tools, nor would he know how to clean it because he never had a gun before. He got it from a friend of his, and so who knows when it would have been cleaned before? And it was carried outside and inside, and if those guns aren't oiled and cleaned properly, they build rust, up rust, and particularly rust in the barrel. And so most guns in the, you know, the witnesses say that most guns in the hands of, you know, just your regular people, people would have rust in the barrel of some sort. And if it builds up, what happens is that the rust leaves marks on any bullets that are shot from the gun. And it was, at the time, gun experts, ballistics experts, did not know. They knew that the rifling in a gun left marks on a bullet, but they didn't know that, you know, it was like a fingerprint. That no two barrels left the same marks on a gun. You know, we're familiar with that now too, right? What do the ballistics tests say? And, you know, do the marks match? And that wouldn't come until the 1920s. Extensive research that would show that no two bullets fired from different guns would have the same marks. So what the Victorian ballistics experts, and there were no trained ballistics experts, they were just gunsmiths, right, they would they would try to match guns by saying, well, you know, this one's heavily rusted, and I see these rust marks on the bullet, you know, from I test fired one, and there's similar marks made by the rust on that one as the one that was dug out of, you know, John Marshall's body. And that was right. How the whole, you know, the ballistics worked at that time.
Let's get to this David Franklin Ierley, why he's this, what is the relationship between him and Strobel, and how does it come, and for what reason possibly would this person confess, and what did he confess to?
Yes, David Ierley was 14 years old. He was the oldest son of Ierley family, which had moved there in the 1890s. His mom was sick, and she was away, and the sisters were away. So he was living in the house with his dad, who was a hardworking carpenter, handyman, and things, and his two younger brothers. And Ierley, like I say, he was a disturbing little fellow. He took it into his head to torment Strobel as much as he could, pelting him with rocks all the time. And of course, Strobel could never catch him because of his leg. But at some point, Ierley decided that he wanted to confess to the crime after it happened. And he said that he told Moresby, and then he told Moresby that Strobel had come the night of the murder, and the two of them had gone up to Marshall's place, and Strobel had gone in. Ierley was outside, heard a couple of shots, and Strobel came back with some money, and they headed back. For Moresby, this was it, right? This was the clincher. And he, of course, arrested Ierley for being an accomplice to the murder and robbery. And the first trial was a trial against Strobel and Ierley. So even though the two of them were enemies, they faced the charges together during the first trial, by which time Ierley had withdrawn his confession, this lengthy confession that he had given to Moresby, and he had told another, like while they were waiting in prison, he had told another prisoner the reason why he concocted this story was he thought that, you know, Moresby would bring him to New Westminster and put him up in a nice hotel and pay him $3.50 a day for being a witness. And so that something wasn't quite right in this guy's mind. And it added a very fascinating twist to the whole thing. Now in the first trial, it all falls apart. I mean, this guy gets up on the stand. He can't. The law had just changed so that now defendants could testify at their own trial. Right. Up until then, defendants couldn't. And so he gets up in the stand, and it's pretty obvious from the get-go that this guy just full of it, right? His story is completely concocted and so forth. And so the Crown drops the charges against him. But that harms their case so much that in the first trial, the jury is a hung jury. They can't decide on the charges against Strobel, mostly because Ierley had so screwed up the Crown's case.
You talk about the first trial, though, with the ability for a defendant to take the stand in his own defense. You write that the jurors at that time expected, because of this law, that they expected the defendants to take the stand. So if they didn't, you didn't have to, but if you didn't, the jury would look unfavorably upon the defendant because of it. And Strobel testified at the first trial as well.
Yes, he did.
And like you,
yes.
Like you say, in this trial, he was represented by a very competent attorney named Ollie Morrison. And as you write, the kind of vigorous defense that he employed at this trial was unusual at the time. And you say that the judicial system wanted a much more decorum to the to the proceedings in court, and so that right from the very beginning, the judge McCrate looked unfavorably on Morrison for his tactics in defending Albert Strobel, didn't he?
Yeah, I mean that was more at play in the second trial, where Morrison. Morrison had to become very aggressive in the second trial. The first trial,
right.
Morrison was a sharp attorney. He was, when we think of a defense lawyer, you know, kind of like a pit bull, he fit that mold very much. Mm-hmm. And that was his natural ability. Back then, that was frowned upon because, of course, you know, the court of law has to be respectful and everybody's respectful and so forth. And that style would really come into play more in the second trial than in the first. But yes, I mean, putting Strobel on the stand, in a sense, this was the first case that Morrison tried where his defendant went to the stand, so he wasn't experienced in this, but he did know. I mean, it's the 1890s, and it's like, well, if you're innocent, you have nothing to hide. I mean, people still say that, and I can't believe that they do, because it's just not true. Everybody has something to hide. That's our right to. And you know, the farmers and the merchants that sat on the jury say, well, we want to. Guilt or innocence is almost more about are you a moral person or not? And if you're a moral person, you'll get up there and you'll defend yourself. And in all the other trials at the assize, the defendants got up and testified. Even in the trial, and actually the trial that happened just before, when the guy was obviously guilty and there was no chance of him getting off, even in that case, he got up and testified. And Strobel did. It was a long test. And he did surprisingly well, given his limitations. But Davy, and this was Theodore Davy's second time he had a witness in defendant in the box, he was very good. But it just, like, the case just was sputtering. And at that point, so
it deserved
all of these
to.
No, go ahead.
Sorry, it deserved to have an acquittal because of Ireley's confession and poor performance on the stand, but also that it tied Strobel to the murder, and with the throwing out of the charges against Ireley, then it seemed preposterous to have it connected. Use that same evidence that's been discredited to then convict him of this murder.
Mm-hmm.
Now,
yeah,
at the same time...
Go ahead. Yep. They used the... I mean, they had to fall back on the gun, right? Matching the gun, and a test was done. A bullet was fired from that gun, and then that bullet was compared to the bullet that came out of Marshall's neck, and the Crown argued, you know, it was close enough. They're a match, and if they're a match, then he's guilty. And so they fell back on that. But, you know, in that day and age, direct evidence, you know, they talk about direct evidence and circumstantial evidence. Nowadays, what we think of as direct evidence is physical evidence. You know, that bullet, matching the bullet to the gun, is direct evidence. Back then, the notion of direct evidence is eyewitness evidence. Mm-hmm. And so when the direct evidence, that is, Ehrlich's eyewitness testimony. When that falls apart, their case falls apart because their direct evidence falls apart. So it was a different legal climate very much at the time.
Mm-hmm. You have Theodore Davy, too, learning from this first trial as well. And being able to use for the second trial, and as you write in the book, it's very surprising to see the trial scheduled for so soon. There was a possibility
yes.
that the trial would be delayed for 6 months. They said, let's change this venue. Let's take it from New Westminster to Victoria, you know, cross to the island to Victoria. And at the same time, what was interesting is that Strobel, with this deadlocked jury, he thought he was acquitted. That's how
mm-hmm.
stunned this guy was about what was going on. So he actually thought that this was a big victory for himself, but this next trial was scheduled for 2 weeks, only 2 weeks later, wasn't it?
Yes, yes.
So now, what changes in this second trial in terms of both people being prepared because some of the similar witnesses and evidence was still germane to this second trial. Very much the about the guns, about the bullets being found by David Lucas. Tell us a little bit about the David Lucas discovery of these bullets and what was questionable about that, and what Ollie Morrison was limited by in terms of hiring a gun expert and what really qualified as expertise in firearms at that time?
All of the important evidence used in the case, the physical evidence, was collected by David Lucas. And it was just collected, taken, he stored it for 2 weeks in a trunk and then handed it over to Moresby. And the really question the evidence that raised the eyebrows of Morrison was were the two empty cartridges that Lucas found beneath the window of Strobel's hotel room. Now, it had been raining. This is November, December. You're back in Ontario, so you get snow. We get rain. And it had been raining,
yeah.
and the streets were muddy. And somehow, Lucas found these two empty cartridges right underneath Strobel's window, lying in a kind of a, you know, wet mud. They were lying right on top of the mud, and they were clean, bright and clean. So, one, they were clean after all this time out there in the mud, and two, nobody, you know, the police had inspected this alley before, and they hadn't found these cartridges. And that becomes an issue. Of course, Morrison brings it up in both trials, especially in the second trial, that where he accuses Lucas of planting those two cartridges, and those become the cartridges that, you know, in the jury's mind, or the question is, of course, well, these are the cartridges that Strobel would have taken out. It's a revolver, so when you fire it, the cartridge doesn't eject, as opposed to like an automatic handgun. The empty cartridge stays inside the gun. And so the Crown was arguing Strobel took the two cartridges, empty cartridges that he had shot Marshall with, took them out of the gun and threw them outside his window. Morrison is saying, well, you know, they're clean. They're sitting on top there. These have been planted. And like I say, you know, Lucas just, he's a character that keeps giving in a story. He's asked, well, what made you look in the alley at this time? Because Lucas was going all around Sumas City in the day, 2-3 days after the shooting, looking for evidence. And he was asked, well, what made you look in the alley at this time? And he said, well, he had dreamt about it. He had dreamt about the cartridges sitting in the alley. And Morrison just, you know, when he said that, it was just, you know, quite the reaction. He asked Lucas, "Well, what religion are you, Mr. Lucas?" And he said, "Well, I used to try being a Christian, but I'm not a spiritualist. Now I belong to the Odd Fellows." So it was quite the funny exchange.
Now with this here, you have what's fascinating is Judge Walken's behavior at the second trial. Now you write that it's interesting because this is new territory where you have a defendant testify on the stand in his own defense. So Albert Strobel got up, and they had the benefit. Theodore Davy had the benefit of his first confession or his first appearance, so that was transcribed. So he had Strobel off balance with the little gaps or inconsistencies that he had in his testimony. But what's most important and surprising and shocking was that Judge Walken basically interrupted Morrison, which he was now really peeved at, because he said that mm-hmm. Morrison was denigrating these respectable witnesses' character and their credibility was questioned. So what he did, in effect, was not allow Morrison to allow a direct examination of Albert Strobel, and in effect, interrupting constantly, as you write, he acted like a cross-examination, the judge mm-hmm. acting as a cross-examiner rather than the prosecution itself.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us a little bit more about this behavior and how unusual it was.
Yes. I mean, Strobel's testimony was one of the two decisive factors in the second trial. The other was a more convincing link between his revolver and one of the bullets in Marshall, because Davy had done his work better on that, and that evidence was presented better. But the other decisive part, and Davy admits afterwards, was Strobel's testimony. The first iffy thing, eye-raising brow, was when Walken allowed Strobel's full testimony from the first trial, when he allowed for it to be read, 3 hours of reading, into the record in the second trial. So not only did Davy have access to that, you know, transcript, but now the jurors heard his testimony in trial number one. So when Strobel then now has to get onto the stand to defend himself, and he's kept on the stand for 8 or 9 hours over 2 days, and literally the stand, he wasn't allowed to sit, and witnesses weren't allowed to sit except for women witnesses, women and girls that were brought in to testify. And during that testimony, most of it was taken up, 4 or 5 hours were taken up by Davy, and the rest of the time was taken up by Walken questioning, the judge questioning Strobel. Morrison got very little time to question him. He would set up and say, like, start Strobel going with the story, and then a few minutes in, Walken would start directly questioning Strobel. So during the time when Strobel is supposed to be questioned by his own defense counsel and have the opportunity to give his version, during that time, Walken intervened and took over the questioning. And, you know, on each step and each of the details. And then it was Davy's turn to cross-examine. So of those 9 hours, almost all of it was cross-examination by the judge and cross-examination by the Crown Counsel.
Mm-hmm.
And very, very little questioning, examination by his own counsel. And the reason is that there are no precedents. This was the second trial in British Columbia. Oh, well, now it's the third or fourth trial where the defendant is testifying. There's the new criminal code didn't specify what the rules were when a defendant was testifying. And there was no common law precedent that said, well, the judge can't just step in and grill like this. So there were no legal protections that would guarantee the defendant the right to just unimpeded give his version of events.
Mm-hmm. Now let's talk about the verdict and what happens with this case. Obviously, he's convicted, but tell us about the public reaction and about the press reaction to this verdict, and also the reaction from Margaret Bartlett, Elizabeth Bartlett, and from Strobel himself.
Yeah, the reaction to the verdict was amongst the public, it was actually quite split. Amongst in the gallery of the courtroom itself, you had boos as well as cheers. Amongst readers in Victoria, New Westminster, whatever, who were following the trial, you had a split as well. And as soon as the verdict came down, there were moves to start a petition for an appeal. And the newspapers themselves were strongly, they actually did a very, very good job, an even-handed job, of presenting the testimony without comment. So you had these long, long columns of the trial coverage, where it was fairly accurate. But once the verdict came in, they were able to say, yeah, we told you so. We said he was guilty from way back, and so all of the press supported the verdict. Half of the public did, half didn't. Margaret Strobel and Margaret and Elizabeth Bartlett were Elizabeth Bartlett collapsed, crying. Margaret Strobel as well. Margaret Bartlett as well, sorry. Strobel himself didn't react at first, and then as he was being carried out, it kind of hit him that he had never believed up to the point that he would be convicted, because he thought that he could talk his way out of everything. But as he was being carried out, he started yelling and screaming and protest. Oh, it doesn't matter, but it's okay. It doesn't matter, and so forth. So it finally hit him, and he showed some emotion and defiance in the face of the verdict. So that was the immediate reaction to the verdict.
Now we talked about Strobel being emotionally delayed or slow. He meets with Elizabeth because this love of his life, and you had mentioned before that he was told by the mother, Margaret, that if this wouldn't have happened, he would have been married. So talk about the conversation, and talk about the conversation that Elizabeth had with Strobel and what she asked him and who was also listening at that same time, and what did they do as a result?
Yes, Elizabeth visited Strobel the day, I believe it was the day after the conviction. I visited him in prison. He was kept apart from the regular population on the equivalent of death row in New Westminster jail. And she was escorted to his cell, and actually, it's not like the guards went away, or one of the people escorting her was the superintendent of police, Frederick Hussey. And she asked him, you know, did he do it? Because she had all along said, no, you know, she believed that he didn't do it. And he all along said he didn't. And at this point, right, he admitted that, yes, he had shot her, Marshall. But he said, oh, but it was because of you. And she, you know, she was shocked, of course, mm-hmm, as shocked as with the, and says, well, what do you mean because of me? Like, well, we argued over you. And she said, well, you shouldn't have argued. You should have just let it go anyway. And so the guards and Hussey heard this. And what Hussey does is he gets her into, he was taking notes. He gets her into a side room. And he has a statement that of what they just said, that Strogel had told her, Elizabeth, that he had shot her, and so, and he gets her to sign. Hussey gets her to sign the statement.
Right.
So, you know, it's a confession.
Yeah.
And then a number of he confesses to a newspaper reporter. He confesses to his lawyer. They try to get it all, you know, Morrison tries to get control of this, but it spirals out of control. He eventually confesses to Hussey. Each time his story gets told, he says he shot Marshall, but it was because they had a fight and Marshall came at him angry, and that's why he shot him. So it was like self-defense is how he was arguing with these confessions, but they were confessions nonetheless. They were saying something that he had denied for 9 months.
Yeah, he had said that Marshall said something derogatory about Elizabeth, and so then that was the argument ensued, and he was enraged to the point of murder here. But Morrison tried to do his very best for a client that he felt was innocent. And then I think a client that he felt didn't get a fair trial because of the judge's behavior and the missteps by his own client itself. But to no avail would he keep his mouth shut. So he really couldn't be helped at all. And there really wasn't, even though he had a hearing about this evidence, it didn't make any difference in this, did it? People lost all kinds of sympathy for him, believed he was guilty.
Yes, yeah. As soon as the confession came out, the support for him completely evaporated. You know, mainly because he had been so adamant that he hadn't been there at all that night.
Yeah.
And so people who had supported him now say, well, you said you lied. You know, we don't care, in a sense, now that you changed your story completely, that you actually did kill him, whether it was for self-defense or not, you lied. So all of that public support for him vanished. And there was this hearing, but in a lot of ways it was an improper hearing. There was no public at the time. There was no avenue to appeal a conviction. There wasn't an appeal court. There was you could make an appeal on a point of law, but there was none of those in the case either. So Strobel thought, okay, well, that didn't work. Saying it innocent didn't work. Now, if I confess and just explain, that you know, then they'll either let me go or they won't execute me. Well, there is no provision to let him go. There's only one thing left that would save him from being executed, and that was that every murder conviction was sent to the Justice Department in Ottawa, and the cabinet had to approve it, and the governor general had to approve it. And it was at that point, all the information was sent to them, the trial notes, all that stuff. And they had the power to commute the sentence to life in prison or to let the sentence stand. That was the only avenue he had at that point. And he didn't, I mean, you know, he's not a lawyer. He didn't understand that. He still thought he could talk his way out of it. But there were no provisions, you know, to go, even with what we would see as the flagrant violations in law. At the time, they weren't, because there was no law, and there had been no case law to say, well, this is the way defendants are supposed to be treated when they're in the witness box. This is the law. This is the new law. You can't use a transcript from a previous, you know. And Morrison's argument, which actually was quite a good one, was that Strobel's testimony from the first trial was voluntary. He didn't have to make it. He argued you can't use that in this trial, but he was overruled. So there was no question of law, and there was no avenue to appeal.
Right. This has been very fascinating, talking about the trials of Albert Strobel. Needless to say, his protestations didn't work out, and he was executed. I want to thank you very much for coming on and talking about the trials of Albert Strobel, Love, Murder, and Justice at the End of the Frontier. I know this is a Caitlin Press release, caitlinpress.com. Tell us how they might find out more information about this case and find out more about this book.
Well, find out more about the book is you know, buy it.
Yes.
I have to put that plug in. It's available on Amazon, on Indigo. Probably the public libraries will. I know that the Toronto Public Library has ordered a copy or two. I don't know about some of the others there. Indigo, of course, connected through Cole's books. CaitlinPress.com. It has a basic description, of the book and the blurbs on the back, and you can see the cover and that. So if viewers want to go there and take a look at that. And like I say, I mean, it's available for ordering and any of the, you know, the major online store places.
Absolutely. Well, I want to thank you very much, Chad Reimer, for The Trials of Albert Strobel, Love, Murder, and Justice at the End of the Frontier. It's been a real pleasure. Thank you so much, and hope you have a great night.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you very much. Good night.
Good night.